Hello and welcome to your disability podcast for a new episode. We've got a slightly different podcast today because it's somebody's journey and somebody's story. I'm going to introduce people in the room who I've got with me today. So if you want to just say hello, Dave.
Hi, I'm Dave Stocks. I'm the co-chair of the Disability Stuff Network.
And Ben.
Hi, I'm Ben. I'm one of the mental health nurses that work in Liaison Diversion Service.
And if you have been following us from the first episode, you'll also recognise Kate. Kate, do you want to introduce yourself briefly?
Hi, yeah, I'm Kate. I am a mental health nurse in Positive Steps, which is part of Dudley CAMHS.
And today is all about Kate. So Kate's going to just give us a little bit of a flavour of her journey. Where she's at and some of the things that have worked for her in terms of reasonable adjustments and being diagnosed. So, Kate, do you want to tell us a little bit around where it all started and how that worked for you in terms of diagnoses?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was diagnosed with ADHD right at the end of my nursing degree. So I was 29 at that point, and I was on a placement with it was a youth offending placement, and my mentor was an ADHD nurse specialist, and I didn't really know anything about ADHD prior to that. But after about 2 weeks on the placement, I think we both clocked each other, and I started noticing so many similarities between the young people we were working with and sort of my own journey and difficulties. So by the end of that placement, I'd got a diagnosis and started on medication just in time for my first newly qualified nurse post, really. And prior to that, I'd always struggled with school and education. I'd left school without any A-levels, and kind of senior school in general had been really hard. And I'd sort of got this self-image, but also was given the message quite a lot at school that I was lazy and disorganised and not meeting my potential and all those things that I now know as absolutely classic markers for ADHD.
The school and all that system never picked anything up. It was just kind of you were effectively just a bad student, you know, not performing to the level that they wanted.
Completely. And I think that was made worse by, I was very bright at primary school, and I think primary school's easier to kind of mask and get through. And I got a scholarship to a private school that was kind of quite high achieving for secondary school, and within weeks of being there, I always think of it as like the scaffolding started to fall. I just kind of never did homework, was incessantly chatty. I got seen as, being lazy and maybe a bit naughty, but probably not as naughty as I could have been. And I missed a lot of school, but my mental health wasn't great, which makes a lot of sense now in hindsight as well. But I was diagnosed with anxiety and depression from the age of about 12. So I've been in and out of CAMHS services as well at various times, and it hadn't been picked up then, which I think is quite a sign of the times, because that would have been sort of the early 2000s. So yeah, it was quite a dramatic time qualifying as a nurse, starting a job in CAMHS and with this new diagnosis. And I started person-centred counselling at that point as well, which was really great to do therapy on medication. It felt like it kind of hit in a way that it never had been able to in the past when I'd done therapy, but it felt really important to have an extra layer of self-awareness when working with kids who reflected my own experience.
Do you mean the medication gave you the ability to take things in a different way, to understand things in a different way, or what did the medication bit do that was different from
so I guess the diagnosis itself gave me a different kind of lens to view my own narrative through, and the medication helped kind of retain those therapeutic breakthroughs that I know I'd had in the past, but I'd never really kind of been able to hold on to that information and store it somewhere. And I'd never been able to find a sense of focus in therapy before, so it really felt, it was really quite a profound time. And even though I didn't talk hugely about ADHD as such, it just helped me make sense of a lot of things in the past and a lot about self-esteem and the core beliefs that I think undiagnosed people go through, internalising all those negative messages. I know there's quite a popular statistic that by the age of 12, children with ADHD will have heard 20,000 more negative messages in their life than neurotypical children. So by the age of 29, I dread to think how many I'd heard.
Where in your studies did you get diagnosed? Was it fairly on in the
Right at the end. So it was my final management placement, and I'd already done a degree before that as well. I did an art degree before, which is probably how I managed to get through it, because there weren't a lot of assignments and things. It was quite frustrating in a lot of ways, because I realised that I'd done some amazing learning and learned some brilliant things on my nursing degree that hadn't really stuck. So it's been nice. I've since done a postgrad, and being able to study, understanding myself and my learning style a bit more has been really profound. And then, yeah, I guess working, it's been a bit of a journey of understanding myself and getting to know the job and the families that I work with at the same time. So it's been quite interesting.
When you applied for jobs, did you share that you had that diagnosis at that stage, or did you not?
So I didn't, because when I applied for jobs and got my jobs, I hadn't got a diagnosis at that point. So I'd got a job in CAMHS as a band 5 development nurse, and yeah, I didn't know at the time that I had ADHD, because I got it kind of quite a few months before I qualified. So it was only on coming in, and I disclosed it fairly soon on, I think. And I think part of that is working in CAMHS. Everyone kind of talks so much about ADHD and autism and things that it felt probably safer there than maybe I would have felt in different sorts of teams, I think. And I had a brilliant supervisor who has just been incredibly helpful. Even now, she's not my supervisor anymore and I've moved teams, she's been really supportive all the way through.
Sort of disclosing your diagnosis, you found that fairly easy to do, because I know a lot of people struggle to sort of disclose diagnosis, but you felt comfortable with that.
Yeah, I did, and I wouldn't say comfortable. I think part of it is the either gift or curse of ADHD and oversharing and not being able to hold anything in. So I think it's rare that I don't tell people everything straight away anyway, but I think I noticed there were certain things that I would find difficult, that maybe I wouldn't have done if I hadn't had ADHD. And maybe I disclosed because it felt like I needed to make an excuse for myself, actually. And I think there are times when even the way I've described that is quite a negative kind of look at it, but I think sometimes I'd worry that I would do something or not concentrate or be seen a certain way, and I needed to preempt that, and maybe that's where some of that disclosure came from.
I think that's definitely a part of it, and I'm really thought about looking at it that way, because I've always disclosed my mental health and more recently my autism diagnosis, which I have very recently, and it does help, because you do things differently, but the concentration isn't always there, and if you disclosed it, people understand better, don't they? They understand
that completely.
Concentration's been one of my big problems. Some things I can totally concentrate on. If I focus on one particular thing, but then everything else gets blocked out. So
completely, it's that blessing and curse of hyper focus, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I totally understand enough. I think it's a double edged sword disclosure, because you can be tarred with it, but equally, it can really, really benefit how you are in the workplace and people understanding you better in the workplace. So it's a double-edged sword.
Completely. And I guess it's kind of who you share it with as well, whether it kind of stays within supervisors or if, you share it with the people that you're closest to or you work closest to. I'm very open, so I feel like most of the team at Dudley Camps have probably heard everything that there is for me to say about my ADHD. But yeah, it's interesting you mentioned an autism diagnosis as well, because that's the thing I'm being assessed for at the moment. And I think there's a lot of clearly self-stigma in my mind, even though I'm someone who's a massive advocate for autistic people, and I work with lots of autistic kids who I think about my own experience in such a different way, and I can be far more critical and less open about myself. But I think if I do end up with a diagnosis of autism, there's something that feels different about that than ADHD, and I guess it's that social acceptability. Maybe ADHD is seen as much more kind of treatable and medical, and that's why it didn't feel as hard for me to disclose it, whereas actually they're so intertwined, they're not even really separate things in my mind.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm going on the opposite journey. So I've been diagnosed with autism, and I've been recommended that I get assessed for an ADHD diagnosis.
Oh, okay.
Crossing somewhere in between our journey. quite interesting that. So yeah, but it's also getting your head around the diagnosis once you get the diagnosis, because you're still the same person, but now you've got a diagnosis. So Chris, do you
want... it can sort of change that narrative. Yeah, sorry.
Was there anything sort of, I'm thinking sort of pre-diagnoses. So you talked about some of the challenges and some of the criticisms from school and, that negative messaging, I guess. But was there anything that you found either as a coping strategy or just of sort of the different way of thinking out of the box, anything that actually helped in terms of, being different but in a good way?
So I think I moved jobs a lot, which I know sounds like a negative thing, but I always really enjoyed the kind of excitement, I suppose, of starting a new job and the novelty of it. And I've always found it quite easy to get on with people in different environments. So I worked in hospitality a lot. I lived in Australia for a while and worked in coffee shops out there, and I absolutely loved that. And until I found that I'd get bored after about 6 months and move on. I think being able to talk to people and connect with people is a massive strength. And even though I might not always be able to maintain relationships the way I'd like, I think that's part of what makes me good at my job now, is that I can kind of make strong connections with people and empathize. And I think being quite an open book encourages other people as well. I know in my groups of friends, before, talking about mental health and stuff was something that we all did as much as we do now. I think being so open is something that's encouraged lots of other people as well, which is, I guess, why I talk about ADHD so much. I know loads of people who've been diagnosed since I've been banging on about it on Instagram, things like that. So I think being able to share and connect with people is a big strength that I link to my neurotype.
That's fascinating, because I think, Dave, you did a list, didn't you, of all sort of myths and misnomers around about sort of neurodiverse diversity. And one of them is that people can't connect with other people. So it looks like we've dispelled that one quite quickly, haven't we?
Yeah, we can dispel that.
Completely.
The empathy part, yeah. I've feel I've got bucket loads of empathy, and yet I'm autistic, and people think you can't have empathy if you're autistic, and I can. It's probably just how I look at the empathy is in a different way to how other people look at it, and I can still relate to other people, but it's just a slightly different way that I look at it, and so
I sometimes think of it as like a deeper level of empathy than the way neurotypical people might see empathy, like get straight down to the serious stuff. Like I might not pick up on any facial expressions, but we'll be talking about Ashima by the end of like a coffee. It does feel like it's kind of running on a slightly different plane.
I think you're right. I've been trying to understand the empathy a bit myself, and I think I tend to go straight to the point, and maybe in a nice way, I go straight to the point, but I don't like beating about the bush, and that's probably because of my neurodiversity, and I just go straight to the point, but I can see the problem and I want to sort of help that person with that problem. Absolutely. So,
I think that quality is something that I really take a lot from in my work as well. So working, lots of the young people I work with are neurodivergent, and even if I didn't kind of immediately disclose, or if that wasn't the subject of what we were doing a piece of work on, there's something about that connection and that communication style that I think neurotypical is seen as the kind of the baseline, but actually working with the sort of children and families that I work with, it's a massive benefit for me. And a lot of the time I do talk about it openly to kind of destigmatize it. But even if I don't, I think you need all different types of communicators working in these sorts of roles. So it does feel like a massive strength on the person level. It's just the kind of organizational admin diary planning sort of side that sends me into absolute turmoil.
No, that's fantastic. I'm pleased you mentioned that sort of different way of looking at the empathy, because it's going, not being afraid to talk about something, go straight to the point. I think that helps in my role, because my role is suicide prevention, so I can't understand why other people can't just go along and say, look, are you all right? And then if they say they're not obviously all right, then you're not sort of thinking about taking your own life or anything like that. I can't see the problem in that, but other people may struggle in that. And so, it's a strength. Mm-hmm. And seeing those strengths, and it's identifying those neurodiverse strengths. So,
We've got Ben as well, who's just been diagnosed with ADHD as well. So I'm just wondering, do you two want to just very briefly describe what ADHD means, what it is, what, you know, does it give you, like you alluded to the fact that you might have lots of energy, things like that. So do you want to just briefly talk about what it actually is between the two of you who have been recently diagnosed?
Yeah. I mean, Ben, do you want to talk a bit about your experience? I know we've talked in the past about having quite different ADHD vibes, I suppose. So there might be some things that feel more relevant.
I can relate to some of those things. I think that, I mean, I've got to, how old was I when I was diagnosed? I think I was 34, and I'm 36 now, so it's still very recent. I suppose the things that I kind of struggled with were concentration, and I found later on that I kind of developed a lot of coping techniques for my ADHD. So I found that I'd put a lot more stuff into like my Outlook diary and set more reminders. If stuff, doesn't make a calendar, or I'm not reminded by it by my other half, then there's a good chance that I'd probably miss it. Just things, little things like that, really, but that they're quite significant. I think I noticed mine more during lockdown, because it meant that I had to be more self-motivated, especially to be organised, to be doing a lot more stuff over the telephone and remotely. So, there's that.
I think that self-motivation, that's a big one for me. That self-motivation and kind of getting started and feeling frozen. I can sit and spend all day knowing that I need to go and wash my hair and have a shower because I've got to be out the house really early the next day. But I can spend the whole day almost telling myself to do it and not even procrastinating and doing anything. But I do sometimes feel completely frozen in the spot. I think particularly when I'm feeling tired or stressed, kind of going into that shutdown mode. And I think that's a part of ADHD that I guess is so internal. All the diagnostic criteria and the way that ADHD is understood is all the external stuff that impacts other people, so being late or being forgetful and things like that. But something about the internal aspect that I'm making more sense of as I go, and I think that's where some of our like massive fatigue that we get as ADHDers comes from, because people don't see all that internal stuff, or even internal restlessness. I know that's why kind of hyperactivity is something that is understood in different ways, but for me, I might not outwardly look super hyperactive, but internally or even my toes moving in my shoes. Like you find ways to channel hyperactivity in different ways. And I think that's where a lot of us get to adulthood without being diagnosed, when we're presenting in a different way.
Or just being diagnosed with anxiety, that's it. And then,
yeah, completely.
You know, it's like, oh, you're an anxious person. Then. So
I think that's a
symptom alongside ADHD anyway, 100%. Isn't it?
100%. And it feeds into that whole kind of narrative of, okay, well, I've tried anti-anxiety medication, I've tried therapy for anxiety, and I'm still like this, so it must just be me, and I'm just kind of useless and lazy and all these things. It's that sense of failure that keeps kind of chipping away and building that kind of core belief, I suppose. Dave, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just thinking. I think a lot of the problem is we've all been diagnosed in adulthood with either ADHD or autism. And when you're an adult, then the clinicians, doctors, etc., are not thinking along those lines. Mm-hmm. Not thinking along those lines, so they automatically jump down the anxiety, depression, mental health box rather than thinking along the neurodiversity box. So I think a lot of those problems come from the fact that we haven't been picked up in childhood, and now we're adults. It's, you know, they're not thinking about it because they consider them childhood conditions, which is another myth, basically. So, yeah.
I completely agree with that. I think there was a colleague who was speaking to me a little while ago, and they were saying that they went to their GP requesting for an assessment because they thought there was something more going on. And the GP effectively said, well, you don't have any mental health problems, so why are you asking me for that? So I think there's a massive lack of understanding, and it sort of feeds into what you've just talked about, Dave. I think it's very much seen as you're the naughty child in school. You need a label, and then, you know, we can sort it out kind of scenario. I think it, you know, my view is ADHD in particular is very much minimized to that and to a very young age as well. Mm-hmm. I don't hear a lot of voices around ADHD in adulthood and what that actually means for people. That might be starting to increase now. I'm not sure, but
I think it's starting to
seen as a childhood.
But the way it's increased, the way that conversation is increasing is being quite undermined as well. I think a lot of people, especially women, there's a huge ADHD community on TikTok and on Instagram and things like that, and people are understanding themselves and get kind of criticized for self-diagnosing and, you know, assuming everything's to do with ADHD and stuff like that, when in fact they're just seeing people that they relate to and connect with, and they're making sense of things by themselves. And I think it's a real shame that some of those experiences aren't taken as seriously. I think especially when you think about the barriers to getting an assessment and diagnosis as well. I think with ADHD, I think a formal diagnosis comes with the benefit of being able to try out medication and therapies and things. But I think a lot of people see the kind of diagnostic process for autism so kind of harmful and restrictive and deficit based that actually they think, I know that this is who I am. Do I need that label? But then they get undermined for self-diagnosing or self-identifying as autistic. So
here's an interesting question. So I'm just thinking about this. So there are specific stereotypes in society how girls and boys have to behave and how they should behave. So, you know, boys have certain traits that you would foster, you know, going out, you know, building stuff, you know, punching things, that kind of stuff. Maybe not the punching things, but you get my meaning. Girls very much in a different strand, whereas, you know, it's cooking, dolls, those kind of things. Very, very long held, very established stereotypes. So in terms of diagnosis in ADHD in particular, so do you think there's a difference between how boys who have ADHD in their formative years would be seen versus girls?
Absolutely. And I think when the statistics kind of get thrown about of boys being more likely to have ADHD or even more likely to be on the autistic spectrum, I think a lot of the time it is those social expectations and maybe the masking that then comes from that. But I think there's a lot of non-binary and trans people with ADHD and on the autistic spectrum as well. And it's something I did my nursing dissertation on, interestingly, which there wasn't a lot of research back then. And yeah, it makes sense now. Of course, I'm going to be interested in researching and understanding autism when that's most likely how my brain works as well. But I think a lot of it is those social impacts rather than anything biological or neurological, because when you look at the rates and the differences between diagnosis of black children and white children as well, black children are far more likely to be diagnosed with like a conduct disorder or something like that, whereas white children would be more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD. And yeah, I think that goes across the gender divides as well. Not that I think gender is a binary thing, but across what kind of society or medicine sees as the gender divide, I suppose.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's a massive underdiagnosis of women or females within neurodiversity, and I think it's because historically it's been male focused, and part of the diagnosis I think is probably male focused as well, so the actual diagnostic tools themselves need
completely.
It needs to change. I don't think there's any divide in the amount of autistic and or neurodiverse ADHD etc. Women as to men or girls to boys. I don't think there's any divide. The only divide is that underdiagnosed women and girls are underdiagnosed. So I think
completely. And it's frustrating that we know that the rating scales are designed to kind of suit and assess kind of male, typical white middle-class male presentation of these sort of things, but we're not moving quick enough for my ADHD brain to kind of see change happening. And I know one of my colleagues over in Dudley CAMHS has put together some really brilliant stuff that helps pick out the bits of the diagnostic forms and questionnaires and things that particularly how that would present in girls, which is really great, because I think that's something we've needed for a long time, but I think there's still a really long way to go. And if we've got that longer way to go with children, I think the kind of adult stuff is going to be even further behind with that. And yeah, it's a problem that we know is there, and there doesn't seem to be enough being done to actually change that for people.
So we lost track very slightly of your story, Kate, and not that that's about...
No, that's absolutely fine. So, this is far more interesting.
You had your formative, you talked about your formative years, which were quite late in the grand scheme of things in terms of diagnostic. And then you'd finished your course, your degree, and then you'd started various types of employment. Was that beforehand when you went to Australia?
I left school and went and did an art foundation course, and did an art degree, worked in hospitality, went to Australia, and then I came back and did an access to nursing course because I couldn't.
What happened after that? So you then came into the NHS at that stage once you did your degree, and then what happened?
Yeah. So once I did my degree, I went straight into a community CAMHS role in Dudley, which was like my dream role really. So I was very lucky that that existed. And I kind of found various things quite difficult. So I get really fatigued from kind of the amount of effort that things that take neurotypical people very little effort take me. So I was finding myself getting really exhausted and struggling a lot, finding organisation and systems and things like that difficult. Things with lots of steps. So, you know, outcoming an appointment on Rio and writing my notes after an appointment, that sort of thing seems so simple, but it can take me huge amounts of time and effort. And I I think a big turning point for me was when I finally got to the top of the NHS ADHD waiting list, because I'd gone private for my diagnosis, and I had to have a kind of reassessment confirmation of diagnosis when I got to the top of the NHS list. And they recommended going for an access to work grant, which I did a few months ago. And I feel like I've had the dream experience of it. I know not everyone's so lucky, but that's something that's happening at the moment. I'm kind of in the midst of it, really. But they've provided me, the trust had already sorted Dragon software for me. That took a while to get sorted, but I've now done a couple of coaching sessions with that. So using dictation technology to help with some of the processing speed difficulties that I've got. And I've got an ADHD workplace coach as well, who I've only seen twice so far, but I've got 20 sessions with her, which is incredible. And I'm going to do co-coaching with my supervisor of ways to basically make my brain, or make my job suit my brain a little bit better, which I hope is going to help with some of the fatigue that I experience at work, and some of the stuff that takes away from the bits of the job that I am much better at. So the kind of face-to-face stuff, I rarely struggle with any of that. I love it. I think this coaching is going to be a real game changer in terms of helping me streamline what is quite a kind of complex and all over the place and dynamic role as a community nurse. I'm sure I'll kind of be talking about that one in some other way. Maybe my blog post or something will eventually get written.
Well, I'm sure we can do a follow-up podcast about this.
I think it would be really interesting, because at the moment it feels like I've got so many things that they've thrown at me, which is wonderful, but I'm not quite sure how I'm going to use all the assistive technology and stuff just yet, but I'm definitely getting there.
It sounds really innovative, and I think if there's scope to adjust what you're doing to suit the way that you need it to be working for you, if that can be accommodated, I think that's fantastic. And it sort of fits into the themes that we were talking about. Maybe different thinking isn't always a bad way. You know, it's the whole square peg into a round hole kind of scenario, and actually sometimes that does work, and it works for the individual and the organization as well.
Completely. You know, just having someone to help kind of work out what that's going to look like in practice. Absolutely, as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and that's always a challenge, isn't it?
The ideas. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been a really interesting discussion. So we've got the beginning of your story, then we went on a bit of a tangent, then we got the end of the story. So for anybody who has stuck with us for, I'm not entirely sure how long this has been now, well done and thank you. I hope it's been an interesting discussion for you to listen to. And unless anybody else wants to say anything, I'm going to close the podcast for this week. Well, fab. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming along, everybody. And we'll hopefully speak to you very soon. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Cheers. Bye.